Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Gluttony and Glutiny Show. We're going to talk about gluten enteropathy and also gluten sensitivity, if there is such a thing. And, of course, gluttony. Well, we talk about that virtually every week. Thanks for our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio. And we've got guests this week from the St. Clair Regional Medical Center, registered dietitian, manager of clinical nutrition services, and dietitian to the stars, Jean Jones. Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
And she has brought with her UK dietary intern, Darian Burks. Hi, Darian. And also, unfortunately, due to a lapse in security, from the University of Kentucky, UK Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, Rick Phillips, will explain to you how you access us on the wild world of web.
Hey, Tony, you know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right, WMKY.org, Morehead State Public Radio's website. Jump on over there, look for Health Matters. You'll find a list of the most recent shows. There's a summary there. Gives you a little taste of what might be in the show. And, you know, just a hint, Tony does those summaries after the show, so they're usually fairly accurate. He usually doesn't go to sleep when he's writing it.
Although, usually fairly accurate. That's very nice. Thank
it
you.
It has happened. Anyway, there's also a link to the audio. Certainly you can listen to the show there. You can podcast it, download it to your device, listen to it over and over and over. And then after you're so furious, you need a place to vent. Jump over to facebook.com/HMRadioShow. That is where you interact with Health Matters. It's a fan page on Facebook. It stays fairly current. We post to it several times a week usually. It's relevant to things that are going on with the show, things that are going on in the industry, or sometimes just interesting, you know, news that comes across the desk. Certainly we look at feedback. We're interested to know what you think. Do you want us to be doing the show on this topic or that topic? And again, it's just your chance to interact with Health Matters. So we would encourage you to jump on over to that fan page at Facebook. It's facebook.com/HMRadioShow.
Our sponsor for today's show, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, gluten-sensitive enteropathy. And their motto, whether it's celiac disease, sprue, or gluten enteropathy, it makes you go and you can't stop at the poop. You know, Rick, we're going to have to get a new slogan writer. This is just a little bit below anything that we have.
I'd like to see you fire the dude.
Well, that's cool.
You'll need
bad.
Let me tell you what you'll need.
Yeah,
a mirror.
And I'm going to have to work up my courage because this guy's not going to take it well.
This guy is going to stare you down.
Fair enough. These are our fun facts about gluten-sensitive enteropathy or celiac disease. Now, it's gone by a lot of names. We called it non-tropical sprue. That's what I learned it by in the ancient age when I went to medical school. Celiac disease, and celiac is just a word for abdominal, so it is an abdominal disease. And I think the best one is gluten-sensitive enteropathy. First described, fun fact number one, first described by physician Samuel G. in 1888, and he called this on the celiac affection. That was his paper on describing gluten-sensitive enteropathy. But the guy that really started to do some work on this was a guy named Willem Dickey, who was a Dutch pediatrician. And he figured out that when these people ate bread or cereals, they had diarrhea. Interestingly enough, he practiced around the time of the Second World War, and he noticed during food shortages, they got better. When bread was replaced by non-cereal containing foods, and later on this was confirmed with some experiments that said, yeah, if you use pure fruit, potatoes, bananas, milk, wheat, those type of things, you don't get the symptoms. And then once you reintroduce gluten in the form of breads and cereals, you get it. The problem is triggered by wheat, barley, and rye. Those are the big three, right, Jean?
Right.
And they cause a malabsorption that creates a diarrhea. And if you exclude those from your diet, this thing pretty much goes away. And they found there was a part of these, and again, gluten is the proteins.
It's a protein.
Yeah, that come from these grains, and that's apparently the cause. Fun fact number two, it's a chronic disease of the digestive tract. It interferes with the digestion and absorption of food nutrients. And again, there is specifically a part of gluten called gliadin that irritates your immune system, and your immune system then attacks your gut. So we can find, first of all, the antibodies to this. That's one way we can do it. Look in the lab and find that. We also can actually go down with a scope and look and do a biopsy and see that classic inflammation of the gut that looks like gluten enteropathy and virtually nothing else. And that is the way we diagnose it. And fun fact number three, we'll stop there. The frequency of gluten-sensitive enteropathy in the U.S. is around 1% of the population. It is very strongly hereditary. If a family member has it, a first-degree relative, that is mother, father, sister, brother, approximately 10% of them will have it as well. So that is our disease of the month. This month's disease is gluten-sensitive enteropathy, and we'll be talking more about that throughout the show. Want to start off then, Darian, with a little bit about yourself. You are from Wolf County. For those of our radio fans that are far away, Wolf County is in eastern Kentucky, not perhaps the most populous urban county in Appalachian Kentucky. Did you grow up on a farm or did you grow up in town?
I grew up about 5 miles out of town.
Okay. And why would you decide to become a dietitian?
Well, I became interested in nutrition my senior year of high school when I was diagnosed with Crohn's disease. And when I went to UK, I realized that you could actually major in nutrition. So I decided to go that route, and I've just really liked the classes. So I decided to do the dietetic internship and become an RD from there.
Crohn's disease, one form of inflammatory bowel disease, the other one called ulcerative colitis. And unfortunately, as you well know, these are conditions that last, that are something you have to battle throughout your life. We think it's part of your immune system attacking your colon. And in that sense, it shares that with gluten-sensitive enteropathy. But unfortunately, we have not yet devised a diet that cures Crohn's disease. It is something many times you have to go on anti-inflammatory medicines. So obviously with that, you had to really think about what you were eating to make sure that you were eating an adequate diet. And that, I guess, that got you started. Once you started, what interested you about nutrition and about dietetics? Why did you stay with it, do you think?
The main thing that I really liked was the medical nutrition therapy side of it. So I like to learn about all the different diseases and how nutrition relates to it, aside from all the medications and stuff like that.
And, you know, I think it's going to – we've done this on the show before. That's going to really get interesting because we're now starting to understand the relationship between the germs that are in your gut and the diseases that you have. And I'm sure you're aware with Crohn's disease, people have looked at the possibility of transplanting some new sets of germs in to see what that would do for the disease itself. And perhaps there might be at some point there might be a cure just by changing that. So you're in an exciting field. What do you plan to do after you graduate and after you finish your internship?
Well, I'm not really sure. I'm waiting to finish my three rotations in MNT, food service, and community, and kind of see which one I like the best and then go from there. And then I'm obviously from a very rural town, so I'm just trying to kind of see what opens up for me from there.
You want to go back to Wolf County?
I would really like to, yes.
Okay. Now, I guess your family's there. And
yes.
Okay. So, best of luck on that. I will tell you, you know, you see a person that gets an education and wants to return home, my heart goes out. Hopefully we can make that happen, because it is a shame if a person wants to return, an educated person wants to return to Wolf County. We ought to work hard to make that sure that happens. But as you are well aware, sometimes it is difficult to come back home and use your training. There may not be that many places for dietitians in Wolf County, so yeah. You may have to go next door, neighboring county. I don't know. Jean, I had this article, and I thought of you, and so I wanted to make sure that we talked about this some. This appeared in Health Affairs, February 2017. In Mexico, evidence of a sustained consumer response 2 years after implementing a sugar-sweetened beverage tax. Now, you know, our radio fans have heard us talk about this before. We are in Appalachia in the midst of a very, very, the United States' highest per capita consumption of sodas. We are famous for Mountain Dew.
Oh, God. Everybody that I talk to, that's what they drink. That's their brand.
Mountain Dew has more caffeine than just about any other commonly marketed soda. There are some that are high caffeine sodas that are, but it's more than Pepsi, more than people are not aware. There's more than L8s, which is a local soda. And also more than any of the other Coca-Cola products. Mountain Dew is unique in that sense. It also is very, very sugary, very high calorie, and people around here love it. It goes in the sippy cups for the kids.
Oh.
Am I wrong?
No, you're not. You're not wrong.
And so people are raised on this stuff. It also, you combine that with methamphetamine or you combine it with cigarettes and your teeth are gone. Essentially, even without those, it's a bit hard on the teeth. But it sure goes away. So I was interested in the Mexico's experience. Now, you got to realize Mexico, in fact, has the world's number one consumption of sugar sweetened sodas. They are number one in the world. And so they were trying to do something about it. And what they did was they implemented a 1 peso per liter excise tax on sugar-sweetened beverages. Now, we've talked about something like a penny an ounce or something like that. You pay a quarter for a reasonable, you know, for a serving of soda here. So I'm not sure what a 1 peso per liter. Rick, you're an expert in pesos per liter. if I could describe the look that Rick's giving me right now, it does not look like the look of an expert on pesos per liter. But at any rate.
I'm going to ask you some tough questions.
Okay.
And you're not going to know the answers, Mr. Radio Show.
And
host.
So how is that different from last week's show?
These are going to be easier questions.
Okay. Oh, well, that would be good. Last week, you asked me what kind of nuts you would if you were trying to increase your consumption of nuts, and I thought English walnuts, and I thought almonds. What kind of are pistachios any good?
They're delicious.
Yeah. But do they have those oils and things that we're trying to get, the omega-3s and that kind of stuff? Okay, I know walnuts are good. I think almonds are good.
Yeah, almonds are good.
I think pecans are not so much.
Not so much, but they're really delicious, too.
Yeah. She's an expert on how they taste. But see, Rick, I'm not the only one that's not certain about nuts. When you talk about it, you're talking about English walnuts and pecans. Everybody knows that. Now, what about American walnuts? Well, they're harder to come by. They're more expensive.
Can't you just get them in America?
You can, but then you have to crack them with a hammer. They got a really hard shell. That you have to crack with a hammer, and then you get little bitty bits and pieces. You want a big, nice walnut, it's going to be an English walnut. That's all there is to it.
Okay.
All right. So
look, you're the authority on this.
Settle that. All right, but you said
I'm still back at pesos.
Questions. Okay,
I'm
so still pesos back per liter. They put a. Let's get back to this study. Where they
you're
put
telling me it costs like a nickel per liter for a liter? Is that what you're telling me? Because
sure.
I mean, a peso is like it's like 5.2 cents.
Well, thank you for that. I did not know that. And so, yeah, a nickel per liter. So you divide that up, and they're paying a penny more for, you know, a bottle that we would, whatever our 24-ounce bottles are.
Nice.
Know? Yeah. So they did that. And the interesting thing is with that tax, they looked at changes in 2014 to 2015. They passed that January 1st, 2014. And they found their purchases of these tax beverages dropped 5.5% in 2014, 9.7% in 2015. The average reduction then 7.6% over the 2 years. Households at the lowest socioeconomic level had the largest decreases. Purchases of untaxed beverages increased 2%. So the tax clearly made a difference. And they comment that this could be these findings could be replicated in other countries. And I know this penny per ounce tax has been implemented in several cities in the U.S. And it would be an ideal thing, I think, for Eastern Kentucky.
If you say so,
I'd be interested to see what would happen. And what did they do with that money from the taxes? I wonder.
I don't think in Mexico it went for any promotion of other foods, but I do believe in the United States, a lot of places have talked about actually using that to promote healthy foods.
Yeah, I would like to see that.
We're going to promote a break right now and come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Gluttony and Glutiny Show. We're talking some about gluten-sensitive enteropathy, or they also call that celiac disease. We'll also talk this segment about, hard to say gluttony. I mean, it was a nice title, but we will talk about obesity and a little bit about the diet after a person has obesity surgery. With us to say something reasonably important from St. Clair Regional Medical Center, Jean Jones, registered dietitian, manager of clinical nutrition services. And she has brought with her, from the University of Kentucky, dietary intern Darian Burks. Hi, Darian.
Hi, Tony.
Hi, Jean.
Hi, Tony.
Thank you very much. Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease is gluten enteropathy. Whether it's celiac disease, SPRU, or gluten enteropathy, it makes you go and you can't stop at the poop. Oh, Lord.
You're going to have to talk to that guy.
That's true. All right, our fun facts about gluten-sensitive enteropathy. First described by Samuel G. in 1888, a Dutch pediatrician, Wilhelm Dicke, during the Second World War, realized that as the diet changed, the symptoms changed. It is a, second fun fact, a chronic disease of the digestive tract that interferes with digestion and absorption. They cannot, people with this disease cannot tolerate gliadin, which is a part of gluten. It is a fraction of the protein gluten. Gluten is present in wheat, rye, and barley. And when they eat foods that have wheat, rye, or barley, their immune system attacks this protein, and the resulting inflammation leads to inflammation in their gut. Fun fact number three, the frequency is about 1% of the Western population. Remember that number. We'll be back to it in a minute. Fun fact number four, signs and symptoms, diarrhea, 45 to 85% of the time, flatulence, 28% of the time. Borborygmus, that is really intense bowel sounds, the extra loud bowel sounds, about a third to two-thirds of the time. Weight loss in 45%, weakness and fatigue 78 to 80%, and severe abdominal pain occurs, again, one-third to two-thirds of the times. They can also have low blood counts, thin bones, because, again, it interferes with absorption of the things that your body needs. There are some nerve symptoms because you don't absorb vitamin B12 very well. More about that later. Also, it comes with a skin disorder that seems to be part of the triggering of the immune system, and also that can cause hormonal disorders, particularly in women. They have irregular periods, and also impotence and infertility in men. Fun fact number five, there are laboratory tests, and again, we look for those antibodies to the gliadin that is part of the gluten proteins in wheat, rye, and barley. We look for the body making antibodies, and that's a pretty good test. Sometimes it's negative in people who definitely have the disease. The gold standard, the way we make this diagnosis, is to do an endoscopy and do a biopsy and look for that specific inflammation. And then, fun fact number six, if you have biopsy-proven disease, and you go on a strict gluten-free diet, your condition will improve, and it will relapse when gluten is reintroduced.
And, you know, if you're going to have the biopsy, a lot of people will, like, try to be on a gluten-free diet before they have the biopsy, and you don't want to do that. You should be loaded with gluten so that they can see it.
Good point. You really need to continue with your regular diet so they can pick up that characteristic pattern of inflammation.
Yes.
You really don't want to muffle that. Now, afterwards, then it gets tricky, doesn't it? I mean, here's the things I've got. Obviously, wheat, barley, and rye.
Obviously.
You just can't do that. But malt, which is made from barley, hydrolyzed vegetable protein, often has wheat.
Modified food starch.
Yeah, beer. And so you can get this, and you have to really scope the labels and watch for these ingredients because they are a part of a lot of processed foods.
But the biggest thing, I think, is cross-contamination, and that's one of the things that I think a lot of people don't know to do. They don't know to take care of. You have to totally clean your kitchen. You have to, like, get rid of your toaster, your cutting boards, your mixers, everything, and start from scratch because it gets into everything.
And so you can get little trace amounts of this protein.
Your Tupperware, again, your plasticware.
Right. Anything that was involved with food preparation or storage could have these. And, again, you may be rigorously following this diet, which is no fun at all.
No, and it's an all-or-nothing proposition to you. You either follow it or you don't.
And you may still then, if you're using your old cookware, you may. And this, again, it's an immune response, and it doesn't take much to trigger an immune response. Yeah. Remember, microscopic pollen can make you absolutely miserable if your immune system responds to it. And in the same way, it doesn't take much at all to cause this inflammation and malabsorption coming from gluten-sensitive enteropathy. That's our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, and we will, again, be talking more about gluten-sensitive enteropathy throughout the show. But I thought this was a real softball for Gene. I wanted to talk some about the dietary concerns after a person has had gastric bypass surgery. Now, we had a gastric bypass surgeon a couple of weeks ago on this show. You might want to go back to our website that Rick has outlined and take a listen to that because it was pretty sensible things. Now, keep in mind the most commonly performed GI surgery in the United States is something called a sleeve gastrectomy. Mm-hmm. It has nothing to do with putting a sleeve over your stomach. It simply means that they staple off and take off part of the curvature of your stomach, turning it from a pouch or a bag into a sleeve. It is a long tube.
Looks like a banana.
Yep, looks like a banana. And they remove then part of the stomach that makes stomach acid, part of the stomach that helps you absorb food. And so it changes your diet. It changes your sense of hunger. It also changes the type of food you eat. And can you tell us a little bit about that, Jean?
I sure can. you know, I was a little skeptical when we first started this program here, but I have seen some remarkable results from it. You know, it's really hard to lose weight, very hard, and it's even more difficult to keep that weight off once you do lose it. And I think that one of the big factors that makes it so difficult to lose weight is that if your stomach is really stretched out and large and you start cutting back on the amount of food that you eat, well, you know you're hungry. And it's not fun being hungry. And so sooner or later, most people will break and go get something to eat because they're just hungry. And I understand that. But this takes away that problem because now you've got this nice, tidy little stomach and you're not going to be hungry. You're going to get full very quickly. And part of the key to being successful long term, you know, is to not stretch that small stomach back out again. And you can do that. You also have to be very careful what you put into that little tiny stomach. You can't put a bunch of junk food in there, or you could, but then you're going to develop a bunch of nutritional deficiencies over the long run. So you have to be very careful to get, first of all, your protein needs covered. And then
Dr. Lynch mentioned carbonated beverages, popcorn. That's just two empty calories.
Yeah, and it's gone. And carbonated beverages, not only do they have a bunch of empty calories, but you know, even the diet products, you have to avoid them because you can't fill up on that kind of stuff. You have to fill up on foods that are going to give you nutritional value and fluid, things that you need. Plus, the carbonation actually stretches your stomach. So you really do have to avoid that.
You know, I've got a couple of articles here, and I wanted to mention the things to watch out for. And this is monitoring post-bariatric surgery nutritional deficiencies. A guy named David Johnson, professor of medicine and chief of gastroenterology at Eastern Virginia. He published this on Medscape back on Valentine's Day. He mentions, first of all, vitamins.
Mm-hmm.
There are some, they call them fat-soluble vitamins. You have to be able to absorb fat, and you have to eat some fat in order to have them. Fat-soluble vitamins, the important ones are D, E, and K. Vitamin A is also a fat-soluble vitamin. It's rare that you get deficient in those. It's possible,
well,
but it's rare.
Well, D is one that you have to be really careful with, vitamin D.
And he mentions just simply for vitamin D, either you supplement or you monitor it with
check
blood
it,
tests.
Yeah.
You simply cannot ignore this after you've had bypass surgery. Vitamin K is important to blood clotting, but again, not easy to become deficient on.
Right.
He says thiamine,
mm-hmm.
thiamine. Very important one. It's easy to get deficient in thiamine if mm-hmm. you don't have a working stomach, And secondly, it is bad. It can affect your brain. It can affect your thinking. It can really mess you up if you get low in thiamine. So he says a multivitamin with thiamine.
With a gastric sleeve, we emphasize not only that, but the vitamin D and calcium, iron, and B12. Those are the really big ones.
Yeah.
I mean, you need a multivitamin, but those are the really big things. And it needs to be not just any old vitamin. You can't – well, first of all, you know, you can't swallow some great big pill. And, you know, we know that with vitamin tablets that they don't dissolve very well in your gut, so you really don't have a lot of availability for absorption or as much as you'd like. Everything, all the supplements that we use are chewable or liquid. We use chewable. You don't quit taking them. You have to keep taking those long term.
Yeah, and he mentions not a gummy.
No, not
because
a gummy.
Again,
they don't absorb well.
Yeah, you could chew that, but it won't absorb that well.
Right.
A sort of a chew it into a very, very fine granular state vitamin. Mm-hmm. He says it's got to be chewable. It's got to contain a thiamine, and it can't be a gummy vitamin. And you mentioned vitamin B12. Vitamin B12, we've talked about this before on this show. You have to have stomach acid in order to absorb this. Mm-hmm. If you take out half the stomach's acid-producing cells, you don't have as much stomach acid, and you can become deficient. And once again, this affects your ability to think, your ability to your nerves to function, the nerves to your mm-hmm. feet that give you sensation.
It's a huge issue. And there's also the intrinsic factor that's produced by the lining of your stomach as well that has to do with B12 absorption and utilization.
Now you mentioned
they remove that part of your stomach.
You mentioned iron and calcium as well. You mm-hmm. need stomach acid in order to absorb those.
Right.
He recommends either watching those carefully or supplementing.
And I really am an advocate of supplementation. And you also have to be careful, like your vitamins, they need to be formulated just right. For example, they need to contain your iron, but not much calcium at all, because iron and calcium compete for absorption sites in your gut. So we have you take a well-formulated, chewable bariatric vitamin, multivitamin, that contains everything but your calcium, and then that's something that you have to take separately.
Right, and this is one of my big complaints about multivitamins, is if you get one of those multivitamins that's stuffed with absolutely everything, you realize it is formulated based on what goes in it, mm-hmm. but not necessarily what comes out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so if you put too many ingredients into your multivitamins, if you don't think this through, then some of your ingredients, in fact, are going to bind, are going mm-hmm. to compete with others, or are going to neutralize others. And so it is not true that the more vitamins that are in your tablet, the better the tablet is. That's simply not true. And the manufacturers are under no obligation to prove that you can absorb the stuff that's in the vitamin.
Right.
All they have to do is show it's there.
Right.
So that's an important issue. And again, we talked about iron. He mentioned zinc as being important. And again, Dr. Johnson says something to watch out for as well. Because same problem, zinc needs stomach acid for mm-hmm. absorption. And zinc deficiency, zinc is used in a lot of processes. It's an antioxidant used in a lot of cellular processes. So one that would really not behoove you to be deficient in. So this was written for doctors. And he says one of the things that you need to do is to keep a checklist of the symptoms of these deficiencies, and you ask at every visit, recommend chewable vitamins, elemental calcium, vitamin D, and as you said, an iron, and then watch both levels and blood counts every 6 months, especially the first 3 years, but pretty much for life.
Yeah,
you've got to be prepared for that.
I like this checklist. I actually stole that article, and I'm passing it around. It's a good article.
It impressed me because, you know, you think, well, gee whiz, the thing about these vitamin deficiencies is we don't see them very often in people who have
right.
intact
so
stomachs.
So you don't think to look for them.
Right, and these are kind of unusual rashes mm-hmm. or unusual neurologic complaints
mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
That might slip by you. So basically you run this checklist and make sure that you're watching. If you or someone you love, though, has had either a bypass surgery, which really blocks the absorption,
yeah.
or has had a reduction surgery, which is what the sleeve gastrectomy is, which makes it a little harder to absorb, they need to be on the vitamins. They need to be watching the iron levels, the calcium levels, the vitamin D levels. This is something that they will need to do the rest of their life. And so if you or someone you love has had this surgery, do them a favor and make sure that you talk to them about this. This is not something you can walk away from.
Well, I mean, we have seen much older patients who have had bypasses like a very long time ago, and they'll have like neurological issues, even like altered mental status that appears to be something like dementia, you know. And one of the first things you do when you find out that they've had some sort of gastric bypass is check their levels of like B12 and thiamine and everything, because sometimes that's all it takes to make them better.
And unfortunately, you can see a marked improvement if you catch a deficiency, but you can't go back and reverse damage that's already done. So I thought it worthwhile. I wanted Gene on when Dr. Lynch was on. We weren't able to work that out, but I did want our radio fans to be aware. After you have had surgery, it's not like you walk away from that and never look back. You've got to change your approach to food, obviously short term to make sure that it works, but then long term, you got to make sure that you supplement your diet with these things, or you could get into some serious trouble. Switching gears a little bit, we've talked about gluten-sensitive enteropathy, and let me remind our radio fans about this. Gluten-sensitive enteropathy is an immune disease where your immune system makes antibodies. That's what immune systems do. It attacks gluten. It attacks a specific part of gluten called gliadin, and we can measure those antibodies and prove that you have gluten-sensitive enteropathy, but the real diagnosis is when we go down with our scopes into your bowels and we see that classic inflammatory response from somebody that eats gluten. But here's the other thing. There may be some type of gluten sensitivity. Maybe there aren't a high level of immune response, or maybe it's like lactose intolerance. Maybe you don't have an immune response, you just are intolerant of gluten. That's still being debated. There is some evidence, and I sent Gene a couple articles that said, well, it may exist, but we're not sure. But still, I mean, even with that possibility of gluten sensitivity, there are a lot of people right now who are restricting their gluten intake, feeling that might be good for health. Let me see. Projected U.S. sales of gluten-free products have doubled since 2005, $1.68 billion in the United States, and interesting enough, $3.3 billion globally. So the United States is more than half the global usage of gluten-free products, and they are available in just about everywhere in the United States. Talk to us about a gluten-free diet. What are the health benefits for the ordinary citizen?
There are none. I can't imagine why anybody would want to be on a truly gluten-free diet if they didn't need to be. It's a very difficult diet to maintain. And most of the time when I talk to people who say to me, oh, I'm on a gluten-free diet, and I say, well, do you have celiac disease? You know, and they say, no. I'm like, well, tell me what you're doing. And usually what I find out is that they're really not on a gluten-free diet. You know, they may be avoiding the obvious things, but most of the time, they don't really understand the fine details and aren't really on a gluten-free diet. But it is, like I said, it's a very all-or-none proposition. You have to completely avoid it, or if you have celiac disease, or you will feel the effects.
You know, and I showed Gene an article. It says, and I can't quite go this far. They said, well, you're going to eat a lot more rice if you're in a gluten-free diet.
You know, I find that people who really are on a gluten-free diet and need to be, they don't really eat that many starchy things, other than like, you know, starchy vegetables, beans, things like that. I think that after a certain point, they just quit trying to make their diet what it used to be. For one, a lot of your gluten-free breads and things like that are very expensive. The cost is very prohibitive. They're different. They're not quite as good as the other products, the regular products. And so most of the people that I know who are really on a gluten-free diet, they just kind of don't eat those things anymore. They don't eat a lot of bread.
You're saying there's really, if you don't have the gluten sensitive enteropathy, there's no health benefits that you're aware of just limiting gluten to be healthy.
No.
Darren, you're shaking your head. That's you agree.
No, I've done several research projects in my undergraduate career on gluten and its effects if you don't have celiac disease, and there's not been any benefits found.
What about harms?
Harms? Yeah. I don't necessarily think there are any harms. I mean,
causes thinning of the wallet. We know that. Gene said that.
Yeah.
No worse than listening to this show.
Okay, fair enough. Why don't we stop listening for a moment and allow people's sensitive systems to recover?
That's all I'm here for.
We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Moorhead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Gluttony or Gluttony Show.
Just like all of them.
Because we're talking about both obesity and also talking about gluten-sensitive enteropathy. And we have guests besides me and Rick. So this is a really official, we're talking serious stuff show. From the University of Kentucky, dietary intern Darian Burks. Hi, Darian.
Hi, Tony.
And for the last time, this show. From St. Clair Regional Medical Center, registered dietitian, manager of clinical nutrition services, dietitian to the stars, and obesity surgery counselor, Gene Jones. Hi, Gene.
Hi, Tony.
Our sponsor for the final time is the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, gluten-sensitive enteropathy. Whether it's celiac disease, SPRU, or gluten enteropathy, it makes you go and you can't stop the poop. And we will retire that motto with the third and final fractional portion. Let's talk to you about our fun facts about gluten-sensitive enteropathy. Number one, first described in 1988 by a Dr. Samuel G. But Willem Dicke in World War II realized that as the diet changed, the fortunes of war changed the diets of his patients, he saw a change in symptoms, and that was later confirmed in the laboratory. Fun fact number two, chronic disease of the digestive tract. People with gluten-sensitive enteropathy cannot tolerate gliadin, which is a part of the gluten, and what happens is they make antibodies to it. Those antibodies attack their gut when they try to absorb it, and it produces an inflammatory condition of the gut, which produces a malabsorption. Fun fact number three, it's around 1% of the Western population, 1% of the U.S. population. And think about then, we're talking $1.68, I believe, billion dollars in gluten-free materials being prepared when 1% of the population is affected. Now, Gene, you said, though, there is a good side to that.
There is a definite good side. Even just 10 years ago, someone who had celiac disease and needed to be on a gluten-free diet, there were just not very many products out there for them, and the quality of those products was not always so good. And with all of the interest, the market is just booming now with new and improved products. And I think that right there is fantastic for people who have celiac disease and need good products to use in their diet.
That market being driven right now by people who are eliminating gluten from their diet
for whatever reason.
Yeah, for reasons that aren't clearly medical. Fun fact number four, signs and symptoms. Diarrhea, about probably around half the time. Flatulence, 28% of the time. Rumbly and the tumbly, one-third to two-third of the time. Weight loss, 45%. Weakness and fatigue, up to 80%. Severe abdominal pain, one-third to two-third. Also, low blood counts, thin bones, neurologic symptoms, skin disorders, and hormonal disorders. All of this related either to the immune problems that the gluten creates or to the malabsorption that happens from the inflammation of your gut. Laboratory tests, you can check for these antibodies. You can also, it is genetic, so you can check the genes, although they are not diagnostic. If you do not have that gene, it's very unlikely that you do have gluten-sensitive enteropathy. But the way that we confirm the diagnosis is to use an endoscopy. We go down, we see the classic inflammatory pattern. We do six biopsies. Those six biopsies come back with this classic pattern of inflammation, and that's making the diagnosis. And then fun fact number six, they experience improvement when the condition went on a strict gluten-free diet. That means no wheat, no barley, no rye, no foods that come in contact or prepared with these. And that means you're going to use, fresh fruits, potato products, rice, maybe oats.
You know, meats that are not breaded, fruits and vegetables. You can use other, you can use oats as long as they have not been cross-contaminated. And there are a lot of baking goods, products that you can use now, but you have to be very careful to make sure that they have not been produced in a food manufacturing plant where they have been cross-contaminated. Or even, when things are harvested, you have to be very careful, like the oats, for example, that it hasn't been harvested with and processed with equipment that was used for wheat, or rye or barley.
And again, this is an allergic response. It's not like you have to eat an entire loaf of bread before things happen.
No, it doesn't. A crumb.
Yes, microscopic amounts. And Darian, I guess the chicken McNuggets or any
those
breaded,
are probably out.
Yeah, anything that's any breaded meat is going to be a non-starter as well. And again, they mentioned the early stage pure fruits, a banana, an apple.
Mm-hmm.
Those are pretty easily kept non-contaminated. But once you start preparing casseroles and things like that,
and then using processed foods, and
you're going to get in trouble eventually. So it's something you really have to watch with your diet. That's our sponsor. It's called Non-Tropical Sprue. That's the old name. Nobody calls it that anymore. Celiac disease, commonly. Or gluten-sensitive enteropathy. It's the same thing. It is an immune response to gluten, wheat, barley, rye, that leads to inflammation of the bowel. And so if you or someone you know has that or you think you have that, again, you can confirm it with laboratory testing. You also, though, and the final analysis, you're going to need to have an endoscopy and some biopsies to make sure that you got it. And then the diet works. But we emphasize this diet is tough.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're going to sell all your kitchen stuff, and start again. And if you're going to limit your diet and pay more for your foods, you need to make sure you have a good reason, in our opinion. If it makes you feel good to buy expensive food, okay.
Yeah, but you don't even, if you have celiac disease, though, you can do it more economically. It's just that you're not going to be able to use a lot of those fancy products that are, out there. You're going to stick with very basic, simple foods that you've prepared yourself. And you have to be really careful when you're eating away from home.
Right. And once again, with this inflammation, with the malabsorption, we'll see malabsorption, pretty much the same things we talked about with the surgery. You got to watch B12 and proteins and other vitamins. Switching gears a little bit, this final fractional portion. That, by the way, is our sponsor, gluten-sensitive enteropathy. Final portion here. This was published online in the British Medical Journal, or they call it the BMJ now. Strong evidence, obesity tied to 11 cancers. This was an analysis. Body fat increases most digestive system cancers. It agrees. Last year, there was the International Agency for Research on Cancer. They found the same thing. So we want to make our radio fans aware that it is, according to this editorial in the BMJ, excess body fat is potentially the second most important modifiable cancer risk factor behind smoking. So we've talked to our patients about smoking. We've talked on this show repeatedly about smoking and how it causes not only an increased risk of lung cancer, but many other types of cancer. Well, obesity does the same thing. And they've named these 11 cancer sites. Cancer of the esophagus, multiple myeloma, which is a bone marrow cancer, cancers of the stomach, cancers of the colon in men, cancers of the rectum in men. The biliary tract system, this is where gallstones are formed, can also develop a cancer. These are horrendous cancers, nothing you'd wish on your worst enemy. Cancer of the pancreas, cancer of the breast in postmenopausal women, endometrial cancer, cancer of the ovary, and cancer of the kidney, all affected by obesity. And so we've talked about it. This is not someone trying to dictate your body image. If you have, if you are obese, you have a higher risk of cancer. 9% higher for rectal cancer among men, 56% higher for biliary tract system cancer. So it is a strong risk factor for cancer says the BMJ. And I guess, you know, we knew that. It's so frustrating because obesity is such a hard thing to manage.
It is.
Yeah, you've spent your lifetime, Jean.
I know, right? And it's not just cancer. It's related to so many other things. I don't know what else to say about it. You know, if you're obese, you have got to do something to address it.
Or die obese. Yeah. I mean, that's what will happen, right? I mean, that's the fear I face every day when I wake up. I mean, I've tried to lose weight my entire life. It's been a constant battle.
And it's just so much more complicated than I think we at one time thought it was. It's not really just calories in versus calories out. It's just not that simple. It's not.
Well, and it's not just – I guess it could be as simple as going out and running 5 miles a day, but then what about your knees and what about all the other things that happen and the pains and so life is a balance between miserable and happy, right? Yeah. I mean, that's what we find ourselves doing is migrating somewhere between miserable and happy, you know, or ecstatic maybe. You gotta do something that's a little better than happy just so that you average out into happy. Usually in my case, you know, an obese person, they make the exception and go for, you know, the chocolate pie and don't go for the run. I mean, that's what I use to get to that median happy point. And, you know, so the minute they either make food taste bad or 5K runs fun, I mean, I'm in a dilemma.
Meanwhile, we have to avoid at all costs staying on the air too long. Rick, can you...
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Brian Courtney, and Eric Bilber here with our Health Matters theme song. And to you, our loyal radio fans, remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these side effects that Health Matters shares with Linzess, a $400 a month treatment for constipation.
Health Matters is a prescription radio show used in adults to treat irritable bowel syndrome with constipation and chronic constipation. It is not known if Health Matters is safe and effective in children less than 18 years of age.
In laboratory studies, baby mice listened to Health Matters and they died. Do not play Health Matters for children who are less than 6 years of age. I'm not making this up, by the way. It could harm them. Health Matters can cause severe diarrhea, and your child could get severe dehydration due to loss of a large amount of body water and salt.
Health Matters can cause serious side effects, including diarrhea, which can sometimes be severe. Diarrhea often begins within the first 2 weeks of our show. Stop listening to Health Matters and call your doctor right away if you get severe diarrhea during the show.
Other common side effects of Health Matters include gas, abdominal pain, swelling, or a feeling of fullness and pressure in your abdomen. Call your doctor or go to the nearest hospital emergency room right away if you develop unusual or severe stomach area pain, especially if you also have bright red bloody stools or black stools that look like tar.
In clinical trials, 20% of Health Matters listeners reported diarrhea compared to 3% of those listening to Mountain Edition.
9% of Health Matters listeners and 3% of Mountain Edition listeners stopped listening due to adverse reactions. That's right, 9% had to stop. Health Matters fans, the most common reasons for discontinuation were diarrhea in 5%, abdominal pain in 1%.
In long-term trials, over 1,000 patients listened to Health Matters daily for up to 18 months. In these trials, 27% of patients had their listening reduced or suspended due to adverse reactions, such as diarrhea or other GI adverse reactions.
Whatever you do, do not take Health Matters lying down. Get up this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.